I'm going to speak on five specific things that we're waiting for. But before I do that, I want to give a little background, because what I do, there's a foundation to it. Or what I speak about when I go places, there's a foundation to it. And I want you to consider every single person that comes into my office when I'm doing counseling. They all come for the same two reasons. One, they're not feeling the way they want to feel, and they're feeling feelings that they don't want to feel. And two, they're doing certain behaviors that they probably shouldn't be doing, and they're not doing behaviors that they should be doing. The interesting thing is the more we feel a certain way, say depression and anxiety, anger, guilt, all those kinds of things, the more we feel those things, it's interesting how we tend to do certain behaviors that might alleviate those feelings initially, but actually exacerbate them later on. So think of the person that might have a lot of anxiety, and maybe they use alcohol to sort of get rid of that anxiety. Well, what does that do later? Well, the more you drink, the more now you're feeling guilty on top of the anxiety, so you think you need alcohol more and more. So we do these kinds of behaviors, and yet we don't realize long term we're actually increasing the negative feelings, not decreasing them. But the interesting thing with that is that it's actually not our feelings and behaviors that's really the reason that they come in. That's just what we all think. It's actually our thoughts that bring us in, because each one of us has a different way of thinking. And unfortunately, we don't have the opportunity to sit inside someone else's mind to see how different our thinking is from their thinking. But before we start, I want you to imagine in your own mind a conveyor belt. And on that conveyor belt is an opportunity from anywhere between 10,000 and 80,000 thoughts going down that conveyor belt. And that's how our minds work. Research shows there's between roughly about 10,000 and 80,000 thoughts that individually we have run through our head on a given day. Does anybody think they're higher up on the 80,000 side? If you're a real thinker and you tend to, like, you're in your head a lot, if you deal with anxiety, you're probably closer to the 80,000. But some people, you know, might be closer to the 10,000, but that's still a lot of thoughts to have going through your head in a given day. So as those thoughts are going down that conveyor belt, I want you to imagine that instead of having to think and dwell on every one of those thoughts — my dad's laughing and I'm trying to figure out why. He must be thinking something. My dad's thinking he's on the lower end of the 10,000. But as those maybe I shouldn't let my parents — does anybody want to move my parents to the back section? Because they're going to distract me this whole time. Especially my dad. So as this conveyor belt is going down — see, he's going to distract me. Move him. Where's security? Anyway, so as that conveyor belt is going down and all those thoughts are going by, what most people think is that every single one of those thoughts is important. Well, if I'm thinking it, it must be really important. But that's not actually true. If that conveyor belt has those thoughts on it, what I want you to consider is that I get to choose which thoughts I want to hold on to. Or in other words, I want to choose which thoughts I give value to, rather than assume every single one of those thoughts is important. And the cool thing is the Bible talks about this. Philippians 4 verse 8, thoughts of true, good report, if there be any virtue, if there be any praise, think on these. So what's that saying? The assumption is we have options for different thoughts that we think, but God's telling us, but I want you to think on these specific types of thoughts or value these thoughts. I live in a historical part of California. If any of you have been to Auburn — anybody been to Auburn? I call it Loma Linda Part 2. Because we have a lot of people moving up there, and I'm one of them, so I can say that. But that area is historically known for the gold rush. And can you imagine if we all went down and started panning for gold, but instead of actually looking for gold. We just dug our pan in, pulled it out, and then took it down to whoever wants to value it or whoever does that for a living and said, okay, how much is this worth? And that person would say, all you brought me was sand. I don't see any gold in here. And then for me to say, well, I thought it was valuable. No, that person's going to say, no, only the gold is valuable. And I want you to think about your thoughts in that way. Is only the ones that are good or true and helpful are the gold pieces. So as that conveyor belt's going down, you can imagine only pulling off the pieces of gold and holding on to those versus just any thought going by. Now, why do I tell you this? Well, in our world right now, we have a lot of people who are arguing. Have you noticed that? A lot of people that disagree on just about any topic, and I don't want to get political, so I'm not going to talk about which topics those are. But if you notice, people are not just arguing about problems, they're arguing about solutions. And I would suggest the reason we don't agree on the solutions is because we haven't yet agreed on what the problem is. We all have different thoughts about what the problem is. So we're all going to have different thoughts on the solution. So we're never going to come together and have the same solutions because we all think differently about the problems. So I want to take this and I want to connect this to what some of the things that I hear, and I know this is a university, so I'm assuming most of you are in the student category, although I see a lot of people that were here 6 years ago, so I'm thinking not all of you are students anymore, but I'm glad to see you guys too. I want to share some things that I see. I actually brought an easel. Well, I didn't bring the easel, but I brought the boards, but I'm not sure that it's big enough to even see. Do you want me to pull it out anyway? Okay, let's try this. That was lighter than I thought. So if you can see this, this is the first thing, or the first thought that I have, that I hear as a therapist, that students will come to me or young people will come to me and ask me. And it's not just an ask, but it's a, you know, something that they're concerned about. This first one is usually the young person that is in the pre-career stage. And this person will say, I really want to do something for God, but how do I know what this is? So this is a thought, but I want you to consider with this thought that this thought has an assumption behind it. And one of the assumptions is that I'm actually ready to do that big thing. Does that make sense? That's an assumption or a thought about this. And so the second one that I want to suggest as an assumption to this is that I have to know right now or soon. Does that make sense? So I want to know what, I really want to do something big for God, but how do I know what that is? Well, the assumption is that one, that I'm ready, and two, that I have to know right now, right? Okay, I want to give you another one. If you can see this one. I'm tired of waiting for an Adventist guy or girl. He or she is so much more, you fill in the blank, than all the other Adventist guys or girls I meet, and he or she treats me so well. It doesn't really matter if he or she is Adventist. God understands. What is the assumption in this one? Now, if we were a smaller group, I'd probably ask, but I'm going to tell you what I see the assumptions are. How I feel is a good indication of how things are. Isn't that one of the assumptions in this? If I feel tired, then that's an indication that I need to hurry up and do this already. When I was working in a group home, actually when I was attending Advent Hope, I worked with a lot of teenagers, and these teenagers were difficult. And one of the things they would ask me is, Amanda, they would actually say Miss, and they would say, hey, Miss, are you married? And I'd say, no. And they'd say, how come? If I were your age, I'd be married already. The second assumption is that waiting would be emotionally, physically, socially, and spiritually detrimental to my health. Is that not true? Isn't that an assumption in this statement or this belief? Also, this person is the only chance I will have at a relationship. Another one, I won't have other problems to deal with later. And then the last one I thought of is, God cares more about my romantic life than my salvation. That's another assumption. Now the next one I want to share with you had to be resourceful here because I was limited. I can't stand this. It's too much. Obviously, I'm doing something wrong. God doesn't want me to suffer like this. There are some assumptions in this statement, too, or this belief. One of the assumptions is feelings are an indication of truth. Don't we do a lot of things based on our feelings? Or we assume a lot of things based on how we feel? One of the things that I like to tell people is, if you have a child and your child is scared to go to school, pre-COVID, of course, if your child is scared to go to school and your child says, no, I don't want to go to school, mommy, I don't want to go to school, daddy, and is the parent going to say, oh, well, if you're scared, then you should just stay home until you don't feel scared anymore? Would that be a good parent? No, because there's certain things that are helpful about school. But oftentimes as adults, if we feel a certain way, what do? We make decisions based on that feeling rather than the facts that support or don't support the situation. Another assumption to this would be suffering is a bad thing and can't be used by God to teach me. Another assumption is suffering can't be used to glorify God. The next one. I'm going to have to come back to these. That's why I'm organizing. It doesn't do any good to pray for people and tell them about God. They never change or convert. In fact, they give me a hard time and ignore what the Bible and God says. What are some of the assumptions with this one? One, conversion is dependent on timeliness, specifically what I think timeliness is. Two, what I see right now is an indication of what is happening or what the Holy Spirit is doing in their heart. And three, what people do to me right now is an indication of the future. Sometimes we get really impatient with people because they're not doing what we think they should do right in this moment, especially when it comes to, some of you have probably done canvassing or colporting, or you're just working with people, you know, even in the hospital or dental practice, whatever it might be, and we get frustrated because people aren't changing fast enough. They're not accepting what we have to tell them. And then the last one of my favorites, it doesn't really matter what I eat. Do we really think God cares that I eat this every once in a while? It's not like it's going to kill me or keep me out of heaven. I used to hear that a lot. That's why I put this in here. What are the assumptions in this one? One, God didn't create food with any consideration of how it would affect my mind and body. Two, sin hasn't affected the way we eat or we think is good. Three, God doesn't care about the details. And four, what I eat doesn't have any effect on my spiritual life. Now, each one of these I want to get into a little bit more because I think the Bible has a lot to say on these. And the first one, I really want to do something big for God. But how do I know what it is? How many of you have felt this way? I really want to do something for God, but how do I know what that is? And we go through all the training that we go through. We go through all of the, you know, learning and studying and everything like that. And we feel like, well, I've put in like 16 to 20 years of education. I should be doing something big right now. Look at all these letters after my name. I should be able to do something big now. But I want to remind you what the Bible has to say about this. Do you remember what Moses did before he brought the Israelites out of Egypt? Yes, he got adopted into the king's family, but after that, when he went out into the wilderness, do you remember what he was doing? He was tending sheep. And according to Exodus 2:21, it says he was content to do so. David also tended sheep before he became king. Joseph was a captive, then a slave, and then a prisoner before he became a leader. Jesus was obedient to God and his parents and even spent time learning at the feet of his father, who was a carpenter. Don't you think all of these could have said something like that? I want to do something really big for God, but how do I know what it is? I'd like to suggest to you that the story of the talents is your answer to that question or that wonderment that you might have. Because what happened in the talents? Each individual was given a different set of talents and then was asked to do something with that to multiply the talents. And the interesting thing is so many of us, we have something right in front of us. And yet, sometimes we don't do the best of our ability with the thing right in front of us. We think it must be something bigger than this that I have to start with. I would like to suggest that we assume something different and that we assume the thing in front of us is God's way of testing us and practicing us for other things later on. When I graduated from college, I had no idea what I was going to do. Actually, it was the March before I graduated from college, and I did attend Loma Linda later on. But I remember thinking, wow, I have all of this stuff that I've done as far as schooling goes, and I have absolutely no clue what's going to come of it. Nothing. I had nothing in the process or anything that anyone I had been talking to about it. And I remember thinking, how come nobody's helping me find something to do with this degree? I'm just sitting here and I'm thinking, is this how it's supposed to go? What do I do now? And so it was that March, and I remember thinking, well, I'm in a Christian school. I should probably pray about this. And so I prayed and I said, God, I have no idea what I'm supposed to be doing, but you give me whatever you have for me to do. Well, I had had an internship that I had done, and based on that internship, I got asked to do it wasn't an internship, it was a job at the college, and then I was asked to do an internship based on that job. And so I thought, okay, I guess I'll do it. It's not really what I thought I was going to be doing, it's actually in a different field, but I'll do it. And that turned into being asked to do a different job. And some of those were a big struggle to go through. But then that turned into a difficult situation, which turned into going back to school, which turned into a job that was very difficult, which turned into a phone call from Dr. Nedley asking me if I would come and help with the depression recovery program. And I thought, how does he even know who I am? I've never talked to him before. I've never had a conversation with him before, which turned into the job that I have now and all of the other things that I've been able to do since. And I've largely not had to look for a job since. It's kind of fun when you're like, I have no idea what I'm going to do next, but God's going to do something with this. And I'm okay with that. If you ever like spontaneity, this is the best way to go. But the interesting thing is in Matthew 25:23, it says, his Lord said to him, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a few things. I will make you ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of your Lord. Now, I haven't been made ruler of anything, but that's okay. I'm not looking for that job. I don't want to be president or king or queen or anything like that. But the interesting thing is how many things I've been given the responsibility to do. And it's quite fun when you give, you know, the proverbial wheel over to the Lord and let Him plan your path. The next one, let's see. I'm tired of waiting for an Adventist guy or girl. Oops. I think I got these out of order. Oh, here we go. I'm tired of waiting for an Adventist guy or girl. He or she is so much more mature than all the Adventist guys or girls I meet, or whatever else you might put in that. And he or she treats me so well, it doesn't really matter if he or she is Adventist. God understands. Now, you remember the assumptions for this, but I want to share with you some of the things that I've learned from this. I just got married, less than 8 months ago, I think. Just less than 8 months ago. And I'm going to share how old I am with you now. I am 44 years old. And I waited a very, very, very long time. And I'm happy I waited. Very happy I waited. I, as a marriage and family therapist, I've had a lot of people come and tell me things that have happened to them. Unfortunately, I don't get to see all the good marriages. They don't usually come to me. And I'd like to spend more time with people who have good marriages, but I get to spend time with people who have unhealthy, sad, difficult, struggling marriages. And one of the things that often precipitates those is marrying the wrong person. And I'm not saying that just lightly. I'm saying that because a lot of people realize later on that they compromised. They put a deadline on meeting the person, and that deadline made them overlook certain things that would have been really helpful to notice before they decided on the person that they wound up marrying. And I wanted to read something I'm not going to read this to you, it's quite long, but back when I was attending Advent Hope, one of the books that we went through during the first hour time was Adventist Home. Have any of you read this book? I would recommend to anybody to read this book. And for the ladies, I would recommend, there are quite a few things that the book tells you to do when you're looking for a spouse. And gentlemen, there are quite a few things that it tells you to do when looking for a spouse. And so what I did when I went through that is I wrote down those things. That's okay. I wrote down those things and I put them on an index card and I hung it up in a place that I would see it often to remind myself. And I'm not saying that I made all the best choices, but fortunately, I didn't make any long-term choices when it came to someone other than the person that I believe God gave me. And some of the things that I see, unfortunately, have to do with children. If you're unequally yoked with someone who is even just a Christian, it can be very difficult. When do you go to church? Where do you take your children to church? Who gets to decide that? That's one of the big factors. But another thing, too, is, you know, even if, and I see this, too, sometimes people say, oh, well, they're not even Christian, but that's okay. They're a really nice person, and they support what I do. But what happens when you're sitting down at the dinner table and you want to pray? What happens when you're raising your children and you want to suggest certain things, but that person doesn't want the same things that you want? Oftentimes we make these decisions for our spouses because we're looking at the short term versus the long term. We're not willing to wait. We're not willing to be patient. And one of the other things that I see too is, you know, just that people change over time. Not, we don't usually change too much, but when you're in that initial stage of, you know, infatuation and love and all that stuff, we often are willing to do things that we're not willing to do later. And so if you meet somebody and you think, wow, this person's really great, they're okay with all of these things, but will they be okay with them later? And there's a chapter in the Adventist home, and it's called Forbidden Marriages. And this phrase specifically, it hurts my heart when I hear it, because it says, you married me knowing who I am. Do you want your spouse to say that to you when you decide to marry somebody that is not equally yoked with you? Do you want them to say, because it will turn sometimes, and they'll say, hey, you knew who I was then. I didn't change. I knew who you were, but you knew who I was, and now you want me to do something differently than I was doing before. And I never want anybody to hear that. But if we look at the story of Samson, I just want to open this up because I have some nice notes here that Ellen White put in here, and I really like what she says here. She says, the history of Samson conveys a lesson for those whose characters are yet unformed, who have not yet entered upon the stage of active life. The youth who enter our schools and colleges will find their every class of mind. If they desire sport and folly, if they seek to shun the good and unite with evil, they have the opportunity. Sin and righteousness are before them, and they are to choose for themselves. But let them remember that whosoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. He that soweth to his flesh shall of the flesh reap corruption, but he that soweth to the Spirit shall of the Spirit reap everlasting life. Some of the time we don't realize what we're sowing in our relationships. Even non-romantic relationships, we don't realize what we're sowing. But each of those relationships are often taking us a step further and further away from the things that are important to us and the God that's important to us. Christ's mission on this earth included abstinence in the 33 years that he was here. Unless we can use our marriage to be a greater ministry than we can as a single person, marriage is not necessary. And one of the things I want to add to this is we live in a world right now where a lot of people are wanting to be married. And I'm not talking about necessarily Adventist here, but a lot of people outside of here want to get married. And one of the excuses they're using is as they look at Christians and even us Seventh-day Adventists, they're saying, well, if your marriages don't work, why can't we be married? And it's a real rebuke to some of us who have made unwise choices in our marriages that if ours can't even stay together because we haven't made wise choices, then why are we telling other people that they can't get married too? The next one that I want to cover, I'm just going to avoid the boards there. I can't stand this. It's too much. Obviously, I'm doing something wrong. God doesn't want me to suffer like this. Now, I don't believe suffering was ever God's ideal. That would be a different assumption. God never wanted us to have to suffer, and he gave us all of the recommendations and all of the commandments to help us so that we wouldn't have to suffer. But we have people in the Bible that show us sometimes suffering is actually not as bad as we think it is. One, we have Job. He trusted in God's promises, not because they were now, but because they were promised. A promise doesn't mean that I have to think it's going to happen right now. A promise can be because I know it's going to happen in the future. And if God says it, it will come to fruition. If he says, let there be light, there was light. If he said that, hey, if you eat of this tree, you will surely die, what happens? Well, some time did pass. But the other thing that happened too that I don't think we often consider is there's a slow death. You know, as sin has happened over the years, thousands of years, what has happened besides just the dying of individuals, you know, when we go to funerals, there's also a death. Sin has brought a death. the trees experience death every winter, right? The leaves fall off. There's a death that Adam and Eve never had to see before sin. But we also have to realize, too, that sometimes suffering actually helps us. I think it's interesting that Joseph waited 13 years to get the promise of his dreams. He was 17 when he went into the kingdom, and yet it was when he was 30 that he was actually given the power to be at the place in his life where his brothers would then come back, and what was the dream? That they would bow down to him. Can you imagine 17 years going through that? I don't think there was a lot of promise in all the times that he was being, you know, persecuted and put in jail and treated poorly, not remembered. But yet he still persevered because he knew that the promise was there. And in one of the things that helped me, especially when I was working, especially with difficult people, is Hebrews 11, when it says, by faith, not seeing the end from the beginning, it means that they will see the fulfillment after the resurrection. They don't know what happened after their death necessarily, but they will get to see the finality of it. And also, Christ received the promise after his death, too. He didn't feel the suffering that he went through was going to, you know, have any promise. He didn't feel it, but he knew what God had said, and he trusted him anyway. And I love what he said in his final prayer before, you know, he went to the cross. He said, take this cup from me. I think this is what we all say when we're going through a difficult situation. But then he added, but not my will, thy will be done. And I think every time we pray, we should be adding that to the end of our prayers, that we can ask for the things that we want, but we also have to make sure that we're in line with God's will. And the only way that'll happen is if we ask for his will to be done. My computer turned off just a sec. The next one, it doesn't do any good to pray for people and tell them about God. They never change or convert. In fact, they give me a hard time and ignore what the Bible and God says. I'm in a really nice situation that where I work, I'm allowed to share my faith. I would anyway, but I'm actually allowed to. And when oftentimes when I meet with people, either in my groups or individually, some of them, even if they're not necessarily interested in God, what happens is as we talk over time, they'll start sharing things, and they'll give me an idea of maybe where their relationship with God ended at a certain point in their life because of things that they've been through. And I realize that, you know, I can actually give them something else. And so what one of my coworkers and I do regularly is we actually invite people to come to church where we go to church. And then after church, we'll have a potluck situation where all those people that can come and share and eat with us and everything. And it's been really nice. But I'll tell you, sometimes it's been really disappointing. Somebody will come one time, maybe come a second time, and then they don't want to come anymore. Or they find all kinds of excuses not to come, and it's really easy to give up on them. Like, oh, I've put so much work into this. Why don't they come? And, oh, here's just one more excuse why they don't want to come. But I've found that if I focus on all of those times, I forget the individual times when people have actually come even further. And I want to share some examples from the Bible and in my life where people have actually continued and given their lives to God. Do you remember the story in Acts 16? There's a story of Paul and Silas where they're preaching and healing and teaching, and this woman who is possessed starts harassing them. And she just keeps harassing them, and they try to minister to her, but it doesn't help. And in fact, all it does is bring more wrath from the people that are associated with her, and they wind up in prison. But then what does God do? He performs an earthquake. He lets there be an earthquake, and the jail, you know, I mean, can you imagine Paul and Silas? It just keeps getting worse and worse and worse. Now we're in prison, and we're being, you know, treated this way. But then God gives them this earthquake, and what does the jailer do? he freaks out. What are you doing? What's going on? Like, please don't go. Please don't go. I'm going to get in all kinds of trouble. And Paul and Silas say, we're still here. And right when they've been so discouraged, I'm imagining been discouraged, except I don't think they really were. I think they had plenty of opportunities to learn to trust in God because it says they were singing. And as they were doing this, the jailer comes and says, what must I do to be saved? So who they were working with so much before, that one doesn't work out. But then sometimes God sends somebody else that sees things that are happening. I remember I was doing one of my groups shortly after I moved to Auburn. And there was a guy in my group, and this was early on when we were doing the group, and we hadn't vetted people very well in bringing them in, and he wasn't in a stage where I think he was ready to really do the work. And he was causing a lot of struggle in the group. He was distracting me. He was distracting everybody else. And we were talking about maybe excusing him from being there. And I'll never forget, you know, I was praying a lot because I didn't know how to handle this guy. He was just too much. And this lady came. She was also in the group. And she came into my office one day and she said, can I talk to you? And I said, yeah. And I thought, oh, man, I think she's probably going to tell me I don't want to be here anymore. This is too hard. This guy's like ruining my experience. I'm paying a lot of money to be in this group. She had flown all the way from the East Coast to be a part of this group because she had heard that we were Christians and she wanted us to be a part of her healing. And she came in and she sat down and she said, you know what? I don't think the group has taught me as much as you have in how you treat this man. And I was like, what? I feel like I'm going to pull out my hair every single day and I'm like praying, God, what do we do? This guy is just interrupting and interrupting and interrupting. And she said, you know what? I think my depression and anxiety has to do with my lack of patience. And you've taught me that I need to be more patient. And she also said, I realized my problems aren't as big. This guy has even bigger problems than mine, and I've been focusing too much on myself. And I was like, what? I didn't even do anything. How did that happen? And we so don't realize that sometimes the difficulties that we're having with trying to convert people. And I think she got a greater Christian walk out of that. I think her heart was converted. Sometimes we think of conversion as somebody just has to turn from not knowing God to knowing God. But sometimes we think we know God, but do we really know Him until our hearts have been changed? And sometimes that's a conversion too. I also had a kid in the group home that I was working at. And I remember I had so many kids, and I swear they didn't listen to anything I said most of the time. But by faith, I said, you know, neither is he that planteth, neither he that watereth, but God that giveth the increase. I might just be one part of this. But I remember this kid came in my office, and I had started working with him after another therapist had left. And we started talking about different things, and it was so nice because he wanted to learn about spiritual things, and we talked and I gave him a book. He'd been dealing with some supernatural stuff, so I gave him The Trip into the Supernatural. We actually were reading it together, and he took it, and he wasn't sure that I was actually giving him the book, but he said, really, I can keep this? I said, yeah, I want you to finish the book on your own now since we're not able to meet anymore. And I believe he took that home, but man, he asked so many questions about our Adventist faith. He asked so many questions about the Bible. And sometimes we let the 99 people dissuade us from the one person that is wanting help and support. But here in Testimonies for the Church, Book 4, it says, to be a co-worker with Jesus, you should have all patience with those for whom you labor, not scorning the simplicity of the work, but looking to the blessed result. When those for whom you labor do not exactly meet your mind, you often say in your heart, let them go, they're not worth saving. What if Christ had treated poor outcasts in a similar manner? He died to save miserable sinners, and if you work in the same spirit and in the same manner, indicated by the example of Him whom you follow, leaving the results with God, you can never in this life measure the amount of good you have accomplished. Work disinterestedly, lovingly, patiently for all with whom you are brought into contact. Show no impatience. Utter not one unkind word. Let the love of Christ be in your hearts, the law of kindness on your lips. One of the programs that I did in the Depression Recovery Program, and I see a lot of people here who help out with that. One of the programs that we did after the end of this program, a lady came up. I don't remember who she came up to. It might have been me. It might have been somebody else, but I heard the story. And I remember her saying, now we were doing a lot of teaching of the Bible, but mostly in terms of mental health kinds of stuff. But I remember her coming up to us and saying, you know, I don't know what you guys believe or what church you're a part of, but I want to be a part of that church. Just the way you've been working with us and the way that you've shown us love. Sometimes we think we have to preach a sermon to people, but sometimes that sermon is in the way that we act towards them and the fact that we don't give up on them. Sometimes people are actually pushing us away, expecting us to give up on them, just like everybody else in their life has. But if you perseveringly stay with them, they actually start to turn around. And it's amazing how learning patience with one person, God will use to teach you even greater patience with the next person. The next one I want to cover is, this is the last one. This whole health message thing. It doesn't really matter what I eat. Do we really think God cares that I eat this every once in a while? It's not like it's going to kill me or keep me out of heaven. Now, we talked about the assumptions in this, but what I want to share with you, have you ever considered how many stories in the Bible have to do with food? Have you ever stopped to think how many stories in the Bible have to do with food? One, we have Eve. Now, we don't always think of that because we don't know exactly what fruit necessarily she took. But that's a story about food. How about the story of Daniel? He purposed in his heart not to defile his body with the king's food. That's another story. Even before that, we have the Israelites. They were complaining about not having the flesh pots in Egypt, and God gave them manna. How about how often the disciples had to pray and fast? That's a lack of food, but it's still about food. And then Christ didn't eat what Satan offered him as part of the temptations that he went through. Another example of when I was working in the group home, I have so many stories of the group home because I think that's where my patience was tested the most. One of the things that I would often experience, because I try to operate off of a plant-based diet, and these kids did not operate. They did. The diet in the group home was probably the worst diet I've ever seen. They would eat chicken McNuggets and ribs and carne asada, and then have a tiny little salad and drench it with ranch dressing on top. And I thought, I didn't know you could eat that many types of meat in one meal, but they would. But they would watch the way that I would eat, and they'd tease me, and they'd go, oh, do you eat the leaves off of the trees when you go home? Do you graze on your lawn and all that sort of thing? I would take juices to work sometimes, and you know how juice looks when you mix carrots and greens? Looks like rust water. And so I'd take that sometimes in, and they'd be like, oh, that's disgusting. How do you eat that? It's so gross. And I'd say, oh, it's like my coffee. You drink coffee, or the staff would drink coffee. This is my coffee and stuff, except it doesn't have any caffeine, but it's got a lot of other better stuff in it. One time I told a kid to take a package of flax meal with him to school and show his friends like that was really good for their brains and it would really help them and stuff. He actually did it because he thought it looked cool, like drugs in a little baggie and stuff. And so he thought, oh yeah, I'm going to do that. I'm like, yeah, tell them this is even better for their brains than that stuff that they're using. But I got teased all the time about the way that I ate. But I love how in certain moments, I could see how that was actually affecting the kids. I had one kid who tried for 3 months while he was in the group home to be vegetarian. He slipped a couple times, but man, can you imagine how hard that must have been when all of his friends were eating meat and stuff in front of him to try that hard? I had other times where, you know, one of the staff members would say, "Hey, do you want to eat? Do you want to eat with us?" And I'd say, "Oh, thank you, but that, you know, I don't eat that sort of thing." But even before I could say it, the kids would be like, "Oh, Amanda, she doesn't eat that stuff. She doesn't eat that." Sometimes they were confused at what I actually did eat, but I just loved how, you know, sometimes they would be really protective of me and they'd be like, "Oh, no, she can't have any cake." And I'm thinking, "You're right, I really do want cake, but I can't have it, can I?" But I love what Spirit of Prophecy tells us in Child Guidance and also in Christian Temperance and Bible Hygiene. It says, "Diet is an important factor. It cannot be too often repeated that whatever is taken into the stomach affects not only the body, but ultimately the mind as well. Gross and stimulating food fevers the blood, excites the nervous system, and too often dulls the moral perceptions, so that reason and conscience are overborne by the sensual impulses. It is difficult and often well nigh impossible for one who is intemperate in diet to exercise patience and self-control." God cares about our bodies. He cares about the things that we put in them. And I like to ask people to consider, you know, if you could have your dream car, would you put a bunch of junk oil and fuel and whatever you wanted in there? No. And yet our bodies, we can't get duplicates of this. This is it. You know, this is what you get for the rest of your life. And often, too often, we eat based on what tastes good and not what is actually good for us. And the interesting thing is some things that you don't like now can actually start to taste really good later on, the more that you try it. And then there's plenty of other things that taste good and are good for you that you can try if you don't like something that does, that you're not crazy about. I want to put all of this into perspective. I know we're getting close to lunch, and I just talked about food, but I want to add one little extra factor. If we were to have potluck out here right after this, and you found out that the food was actually still cold, and that the only way to heat it up was one of two options, the microwave or the oven, how would you want your food heated? A lot of us, if we're really hungry, we would just go for the microwave. I'm just hungry, I want to eat it. Have you ever thought, why do we still have ovens then if microwaves are so much faster? Why do we still have ovens? Why do people pay thousands of dollars for these extravagant ovens if microwaves heat things up faster? Because does the food ever taste as good from a microwave as it does from the oven? It doesn't. There's a lot of people trying to figure out how to do that, put these little little gray things under your pizza to make them crisp better and stuff like that. But they still have not mastered a way to make a microwave work like an oven. And I want you to consider that too in your life. Sometimes we're trying to microwave the results. We want it right now. But maybe if we waited a little bit longer, if we trusted in God's promises, if we considered the way that Christ has been long-suffering with us, not willing that any of us should perish, we might pick the oven more often, the oven method more often. Now, I'm going to do something that might embarrass myself, but when I was younger, and we'll end after this, but when I was younger, I remember hearing a song about patience. And my husband's going to laugh because I sing him this song a lot. But this song is a little kid's song. And some of you might recognize it when you hear it too. But I believe that in keeping with simplicity, sometimes the best things are the simple things. the childlike things. And so I'm going to sing this song for you. But before I start singing it, I want you to consider that I'm a snail. So it goes, have patience, don't be in such a hurry. When you get impatient, you'll only start to worry. Remember, remember that God is patient too. And think of all the times when others have to wait for you. Will you bow your heads with me? Dear Father in heaven, I want to thank you so, so much that throughout the whole Bible, the Old Testament, the New Testament, you have consistently been long-suffering with us. You have been patient with us, waiting and waiting and waiting for us to choose you, waiting for us to trust you and your promises. And Lord, I ask that every single person and family represented here would have the patience of the saints, that we would keep your commandments and have the testimony of Jesus, and that we've waited and waited for you too. And we are so grateful that in all of this waiting, we do have the promise of Canaan, of the eternal, everlasting joy that was set before us through Christ. And I ask these things in his name, I pray. Amen.
This media was brought to you by Audioverse, a website dedicated to spreading God's word through free sermon audio and much more. If you would like to know more about Audioverse, or if you would like to listen to more sermons, please visit www.audioverse.org.